So this week's discussion, we're actually 1 week off in the Parsha, and I want to discuss Bilam. And last week's Parsha was Parshas Balak, and the story in Parshas Balak deals mostly with this fellow named Bilam. So I want to discuss Bilam a little bit, who he was, what he stands for, what we can learn from him. And just to recap the story for those who may not remember the story, but aren't familiar with the story, Parshas Balak begins with it's the setting of the Torah actually changes, which is really fascinating to me. The setting of the Torah the entire time is focused on the Jews. In Parshas Balak, the setting changes to a discussion between Balak, who was the king of Moab, the nation of Moab, and his advisors. And so it's like the camera shifting over to a different scene, basically. And they're discussing how they're afraid of the Jewish people. The Jewish people in the desert had already conquered several nations on their way into Israel. Everyone was fully aware that God was on their side. There were miracles happening. Everyone could perceive the miracles. And Balak, whose nation, Moab, was very close to the land of Israel, was nervous that they're going to come and attack him and destroy him and take over his land. So he's discussing with his advisors, what should we do about this? And he says, I understand the way that the rabbis describe it. Balak understood that a physical battle would not defeat the Jews. At this point, the world was capable of understanding that God was on the Jews' side, that to just attack them militarily would not do the trick. So they said, what are we going to do? We have to find someone who will get God to turn against them. We have to curse them. And he said, I know the right person to curse them. And this person's name was Bilam. Bilam was somebody, he at this point lived in the nation of Midian. He was a non-Jewish prophet. The rabbis say he was a great philosopher, a very intelligent person, and he was the one who had this unique ability to curse the Jews. And the way he had this ability, the rabbis teach us, is that he was able to figure out when God got angry. If you know when God is angry, then you could persuade God to punish the Jews, take away protection from the Jews. And when God's happy with the Jews, then there's no way you're going to change God's attitude towards the Jews. But he understood that when God was angry, he'd be able to somehow allow God to remove his protection from the Jews. That's what he thought. So therefore, he had this ability, this unique ability to detect when God was angry, and he would try to use that against the Jewish people. And that was who Bilam was, and he was spiritually a very in-touch person, spiritually. But yet, we'll see, his character was very corrupt. So even though he was able to receive prophecy, he was a very intelligent, a great philosopher, he was able to tap into spirituality in certain ways. However, he was a very corrupt person on the inside. He had terrible midos. His character traits were very off. And that's really what led to his demise. That was his problem. But he was prophetic. He could tap into the depth of the spirit, receive communication from God. And that's why he was the one called upon by Balak to come in and curse the Jews. He was sort of the spiritual leader of the non-Jewish world at that time. I guess we could refer to him that way. So obviously, as you read through the Parsha, Hashem was against this plan. Hashem, who had just saved the Jews from Egypt and protected the Jews for 40 years in the desert, was not going to be quick to remove his protection from the Jews. That's obvious. Bilam, however, thought, really probably based on his own heathen ideas, that there's ways you can sort of charm God, convince God, give him an offering, and he'll do what you want. You know, Jewish philosophy tells us that, you know, God is one. God can't be persuaded or convinced to do something he doesn't want to do. And obviously, I mean, God does what he wants to do. Sometimes God will say, I need your prayers, and then because of the merit of your prayers, I will do X. If you don't pray, I'll do Y, etc. You can't persuade God to do something which he doesn't want to do. We don't believe in that. But if you look at idolaters and these more heathen ideas, so they would think, okay, you offer up this offering to God, X, and he does Y for you. It's like a vending machine. You put in your quarter, you get out, so whatever you want. You want some rain, so do X, you get rain. You want some, you know, you want a crop, so put in Y, you get crops out. That's how the idolatrous world used to view their relationship with the gods. So it seems that Rabbi Shmuel Hirsch explains it this way, that Bilam was influenced, even though he could tap into God, he was definitely influenced by the idolatrous ideas of his time, and thought, okay, I can charm God, I can convince God, I'll give him this many sacrifices, and he'll do what I want him to do. And that was Bilam's approach. So that was who Bilam was. The most specific description of Bilam actually appears in Pirkei Avos. That's what I want to go through today, is the Mishnah of Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos, before we get into that, so the story of Bilam, he goes ahead and he attempts to curse the Jews. Every time he attempts a curse, a blessing comes out of his mouth. And the rabbis even tell us, from the blessings that he says, you can infer what he's trying to curse them with. So when he tries to bless them with longevity, and that they'll be around for the end of days, so he must have been thinking, I want to curse them, that their days should be few, etc., that type of thing. But yet, God didn't allow him to curse the Jews, and every time he opened his mouth to curse them, a blessing came out. And that went on several times in the parsha until the King Bolof said, forget about it. I can't, this guy is lousy, he can't do his job, and he got out of there. So that was how the story goes in the parsha. It's a very fascinating parsha. Just as a quick aside, one thing I find very interesting about the parsha itself, Parshas Balak, as I mentioned before, the setting changes, and the entire parsha is basically a record of this conversation and interaction between Bilam and Balak. And the Jews aren't involved. There's no speech from Moshe in the parsha. You don't know what's happening with Jewish people in the parsha. They're in the desert doing their own thing, and we're focusing in on a different scene as the camera moves over to the scene of Balak and Bilam. So what I find fascinating is there's no evidence that the Jews knew what was happening at the time. For them, they weren't aware that they had this guy trying to curse them, that this king out to get them. They didn't know that. They were just going about their business in the desert, their daily lives. But yet, Hashem was there behind the scenes, pulling the strings to make sure that he didn't curse the Jews. They weren't even aware of it. So I was thinking, in our lives, you know, how many times does Hashem come in and help us in a way that we aren't even aware of? Just like we see Parshas Balak, the entire Parsha occurs, the Jews aren't aware of what was happening. Hashem was there the whole time, blessing them, and helping them, and saving them, and giving them protection. And they weren't even aware of it. Who knows when they became aware? I don't even know when they became aware of it. Only after Moshe published in the Torah. What?
Hashem interferes and helps you, but you weren't paying attention or something.
Right. Either you weren't paying attention, or even if you were, he's doing it behind the scenes.
Right.
Either of those two. But the fact that in our own lives, Hashem does help behind the scenes in ways we're not even aware of is something to think about. It's just another kindness of Hashem, that so many times miracles can happen that we don't even know of. While I'm on this tangent, there's another example of it in the Parsha. It's Parshas Chukas, I believe. In Parshas Chukas, there's a story. It's a very subtle event. If you read through the Parsha, you don't even notice it. You have to look at the commentaries. But it mentions something called Eshet HaNachalim. It says, I don't have the verse in front of me. Let's see, I have it here. It says there's something called Eshet HaNachalim, which literally means the spilling rivers. You know, I'll quote it for you. I think it's an important lesson that while I'm on it, even though it's not really the topic for today, while I'm on it, we'll talk about it. It says, Alkenya Amar, this is in Parshas Chukas, it's by Midbar, on Perek, the 21st chapter, verse 14. Therefore it should be said in the book of the wars of God, Esvahev Besufa, Vesanachalim Arnon. The Vahev Besufa, the commentators explain, means the splitting of the sea, the splitting of the Red Sea, Kriyas Yamsuf. That should be recorded in the book of the wars of God. That is a great miracle. And also, Esanachalim Arnon, Vesher Nachalim Ashenoto Veshev Esar. The rivers of Arnon, the spilling of the rivers that had veered off towards the land of Ar, the Nishan of Moab, and were along the border of Moab. So there's something which is grouped along with the splitting of the sea. Splitting of the sea we know as one of the greatest miracles of all time. It's famous, we talk about it, we celebrate it. And right alongside that, quoted here in the verse, is this miracle called Eshet HaNachalim. So Rashi explains, what does it mean the spilling of the rivers? So Rashi explains that the Amorite people, find it in here. The Amorite people were ready to ambush the Jews. The Jews are walking through a mountain range at this point. And the Amorites, they hid in the mountains, in the caves in the mountains. And they're ready to ambush the Jews. So as soon as the Jews walk by, they're all going to pop out of the caves and shoot slingshots at them and arrows and clobber them. That was their plan. And the Jews weren't aware of this. I mean, they're ambushing them. So So Rashi records, based on the teachings of the rabbis, the old tradition, that before the Jews arrived at these caves, the two mountains moved together and smushed all the Amorites in the caves. So there were different, there were crevices in the mountains, and there were other pieces of stone jutting out, and the mountains came together and went smushed. And all these Amorites were killed who were ready to ambush the Jews. And the only reason the Jews knew about this miracle is because after the Jews walked by, they saw some blood flowing down the mountain. The tribe of Dan, who was the very last tribe walking, they witnessed some blood flowing down the mountain. That's how they became aware of this miracle. So to me, this is another example. It was a miracle which happened. At the time, the Jews were not aware of it. There was some, you know, vague clue to the miracle after the fact. But it was an amazing miracle. I mean, there was a whole nation ready to ambush the Jews, and Hashem moved mountains, literally, to crush them. So it's another time you see in the Torah where a miracle happened that Jews were not aware of. And after, in this sense, it's after the fact they became aware of it. Concerning Bilaam also, I mean, eventually we're aware of it now. So at a certain point we became aware of it. But how many times does Hashem act behind the scenes for us in ways we don't even know about, just to help and save us and protect us? So that's an aside.
Yeah. Do you mean individually and collectively?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, both ways. Both ways. I mean, the Torah is recording it collectively, but it definitely applies individually as well. How many times in our own personal lives is Hashem there protecting us and performing miracles for us that we're not even aware of?
Yeah.
Sometimes after the fact, we're able to figure it out. Other times, we'll never know about it. But we have to know Hashem's always there pulling the strings, moving us along in the right direction to where we need to go in life. So that's really an aside, a tangent, but it is relevant to the story of Bilaam and Balak. So I want to go through today this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which compares the traits of Bilaam to the traits of Abraham. Interesting contrast. We contrast the two. It's a Mishnah. It's in the fifth chapter of Pirkei Avos. And it says, anybody who has these three traits is a student of Abraham. And anybody who has three different traits, which will contrast those traits, is a student of Bilaam HaRasha, the wicked Bilaam. And this is where we're going to really delineate what were Bilaam's traits. What made up this man? I mean, we said he was a great philosopher, he was prophetic, he had spiritual connections, but he also was very corrupt in his character. And we're going to understand how he's corrupt. And it's just an interesting point. The Mishnah says, it refers to the students of these people. A person who acts in way X is a student of Abraham. A person who acts in way Y is a student of Bilaam. And a lot of the times, actually, I saw this comment made in actually a great book. There's an old book written on Pirkei Avos. It's called Ethics from Sinai. It's probably been around, I don't know, 50 years or so, even more. It was written by Irving Bunim was his name. He was a big activist on behalf of Orthodox Jewry back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. He's no longer, actually his son just passed, his son is also an activist, just passed away recently. But he actually wrote this commentary on Pirkei Avos, and he wrote it down in a book called Ethics from Sinai. It's a great book. Very easy English, very down to earth.
Thank you. I've seen the book, but I didn't know what it was. Thank you.
But you know, it looks like this old book, sort of put in the corner of the library, but it's a great book. It's definitely worth reading.
Thank you.
Very practical, very concise, very clear commentary. I really like it. So he points out that why are we looking at the students of each of these people? And he says, because a lot of the times when you have teachers, the teacher himself, you know, looks pretty good. You can't really tell the difference between, you know, this teacher seems very wise, this one seems wise, this one seems righteous, this one seems righteous. They seem very good teachers. And you can tell what really separates the good teacher from the bad teacher, the good person from the bad person, is who are their students. So you can look at the students and see, okay, this person I thought was righteous, but his students are all these lousy people. So that reflects back on their teacher. This teacher, who I thought was good, his students are these very great, moral, ethical, nice people, upstanding people, so I can see he's a great teacher. So we're focusing in not on the actual people themselves. I mean, Bilaam was looked at as a spiritual guy. The world may have regarded him as being an ethical, upstanding citizen. But when you look at his students, you'll see, well, the students of Bilaam were lowlifes. And therefore, you can tell that reflects back on the character of their teacher.
And his students of Rabbi Akiva end up getting killed by the
flight. Okay, right. So
Rabbi Akiva is not a good teacher.
No, it definitely can reflect on him in some way. I'm not, you know, there's one, it's a very subtle, the way the rabbis describe it, is a subtle error on behalf of the students, and he had five other students who really upheld the Jewish people afterwards. But yeah, and then if it's his students, then it doesn't reflect on him.
Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students that were killed, so you wonder whether
I think you're making a very good point. I don't know. Yeah. Right. So I think that those are his students. Obviously, he was to fault in some way. I think that's a very logical statement. Obviously, not to the extent that they were, because he wasn't killed and they were killed. But I mean, a lot of times you can tell from the students, somewhat about the teacher. So the Mishnah continues and it says, what are these traits we're discussing? It says that Abraham's traits were Ayin Tova. He had a good eye, and I'll elaborate on these traits in a minute. Ruach Nemucha, a lowly spirit, Nefesh Shfala, and a humble soul, let's call it. Humble spirit and a lowly soul. Those are the traits of Abraham. So the good eye, the humble spirit, and the lowly soul. That's the students of Abraham. Somebody who has an evil eye, a haughty, arrogant spirit, and a wide soul, Nefesh Rechava, wide soul, Those are the students of Bilam HaRasha. So those are contrasting. The good eye to the evil eye, the humble spirit to the haughty spirit, and the lowly soul to the wise soul. And I want to discuss each one of these and describe what it means by each one of them. So let's take it in order. So we said that the first contrast made between Bilam and Abraham is the following. It says Abraham had a good eye. So we understand a good eye, the way the commentators explain it here, is your attitude how you perceive others. If I perceive others in a kind way, an open way, I'm happy with their successes, I'm benevolent to them, I help others, I do chesed, that's called a good eye. Abraham is someone who's known for his trait of chesed. Abraham is somebody who looked positively at the world, positively at others. And when you think about the story of Abraham, the people of Sodom, they were the antithesis of what Abraham stood for. Abraham stood for goodness, for chesed, helping others. In Sodom, chesed was outlawed. You're not allowed to help another human being in Sodom, and if you did, they would kill you. It was totally antithesis of what Sodom stood for. But yet, when Sodom was captured, the people of Sodom were captured in a war, Abraham actually saved them. When Sodom was going to be destroyed by God, Abraham prayed for them. And Abraham, even though he personally certainly condemned everything that happened in Sodom, but he cared about people. He wanted them to become better and to improve. He didn't want them, even though they were his enemy, they were antithetical to his whole purpose in life. He wasn't willing to say, forget about them, you know, I hate them, let them die, let them be captured. He was still went out there to save them. That was that good eye. Abraham...
He was trying to get them saved. So.
They were captured in war. He personally saved them.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And also, when God was ready to destroy Sodom, he actually prayed on their behalf. Abraham prayed they should be spared. Now, at the end, God destroyed Sodom. But Abraham prayed for them.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's fine.
It seems like Abraham, I mean, I've heard some of what you said with Abraham, but it seems like he's the epitome of giving the benefit of the doubt.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The good eye means I view everyone in a very positive light. I view everything in a positive light. If you succeed, I'm very happy for you. I understand your success is your success. It doesn't affect me in a negative way. We'll talk about jealousy in a minute. But that's the idea of a good eye. Having an evil eye, Bilam is blamed for having an evil eye. Looking negatively towards others. You don't want others to succeed. You're greedy. We find through the Parsha of Bala, it describes that Bilam, he keeps talking about getting all the gold and silver he can from the king. He just wants to take from others. Not give those, take from others. He was somebody... He was a hitman for hire. He even said, if you pay me, I'll go and curse that nation. So he didn't physically kill them. He was paid to curse them. But he was basically a hitman. He's willing to do anything for money. He was willing to sack to compromise his morals and his ethics for cash. So he viewed the world with this evil eye, this attitude of, I want it all. I don't want you to succeed. I don't care about you. I'm greedy. That's this evil eye he had. It's very fascinating. And I want to take this theme through the other two traits as well. There's another Mishnah Perkei Avos, a famous Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, Akina v'ataiva v'akavod. Jealousy, desire, and honor. Motziyam es adam min olam. Remove a human being from the world. Jealousy, desire, and honor. Remove someone from the world. Motziyam es adam min olam.
Jealousy, desire, and honor.
So we'll see that these three traits of Bilam correspond to those three negative traits of jealousy, desire, and honor. And this trait of ayin ra, this evil eye, is a trait of looking for of jealousy, that you look at others askance. You don't want them to succeed. You don't want to see them. You feel like their success somehow impinges on your success. That's how you feel. So, and that removes you, I'll talk more about this later, but that removes you from the world. And we'll discuss about what we're talking about. That removes you from the world. Jealousy, desire, and honor. So, this is sort of a manifestation of jealousy, this evil eye. I look at everybody negatively. I don't want them to succeed. If they succeed, I'm jealous, because that should be mine. Why are you getting it? And that was Bilam's attitude. So that was an opposite to Abraham. Abraham wanted everyone else to do well, succeed. He wanted to help them, wanted to be kind to them. He didn't want to take it for himself. Bilam's somebody who wanted everything for himself. And his name itself, his name, Bilam, comes from the root Bala, which means to swallow up. He just swallowed up everything. He was a taker. He wanted it all. Abraham became the father, Av Hamon Goyim, the father of nations, is what Abraham means, because he produced, he gave. He gave to others.
Balaam?
Yeah.
I wondered about Balaam. It also has a B and an L. It's both have a B and an L.
Right.
It also has
The same root. The ayin is different though. In Bil'am you have an ayin, which that's the root for swallowing is the Beis Lamed ayin, bala, swallow. In Balak you don't have the ayin, so that'd be a different root.
Yeah, but Beis Lamed
Kuf, yeah, I'm not sure what that means.
Maybe the B and the L, it's interesting in both.
It is interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. There actually is, just as an aside, there are commentaries to explain that the two names together, if you mix up the letters,
yeah,
form Bavel and Amalek. In the two nations that came against the Jews most harshly were Babylonia and Amalek. So Balak and Bilam are the letters Bavel, Amalek. So it's an interesting reference. But yeah. So this was, I guess, the first time the people rose up against the Jews in this manner, and then it carried on through Bavel and Amalek as well. So that's the first trait here. The second trait that's discussed is a ruach nemucha, a humble spirit, humility. And that was what Abraham had. He's a humble person. And Abraham is the one who said, Anochi afar ve'efer, I am but dust and ashes, Abraham said. Abraham said, I'm just a sojourner here. He didn't give himself any credit. Abraham was very powerful. He was very wealthy. He founded a nation. He's looked at now as one of the most influential people in history. I mean, the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims all look up to Abraham as their father. But yet, he was a very humble person. He didn't take credit for himself. He didn't take extra money for himself. He didn't want anything for himself. That was Abraham. And Bilam was a very arrogant, haughty person. Bilam kept, when they first sent messengers to Bilam, Balak sent to Bilam, and Balak told Bilam, Bilam, we need you to come curse the Jews. So he said, I'll consult with God. And God told him, no, you can't go do it. He was a prophet. He was able to speak with God. And God said, you're not allowed to go curse the Jews. So Bilam responded to Balak's messengers. He said, well, Hashem will let me go with you. And he stresses with you guys. You guys, you know, any people who are more powerful than you, you know, more prestigious than you, you messengers are a little bit too lowly for me. I can't go with you. So he implied, it's not because God said no. It's because you guys aren't giving me enough honor. If I had more honorable people coming to get me, I would have gone with you. He felt he needed so much honor and glory. He says later on, as he is blessing the Jews, he introduces himself. He basically gives his own introduction. He says, these are the words of Bilam, who hears the words of God and knows God's wisdom. I mean, he's giving himself all these different accolades. You know, this is who I am. I'm the greatest. I'm the master of everything. You know, that's me. That's who he introduces himself when he starts prophesizing. So we see that there was this trait of haughtiness, of arrogance about Bilam, which is the opposite of Abraham. Abraham was a very humble person, and Bilam was very arrogant. He was full of himself. The third trait of Bilam was, it says a nefesh fala, a lowly spirit, versus nefesh rechava, an insatiable, you know, wide, open spirit. So Bilam had a wide, open, insatiable spirit, and Abraham had a very lowly spirit. And the way that the commentaries describe this is that this refers to their physical drive, their drive for pleasure. The word nefesh a lot of times is used for like the drives of a person, people's motivations and their drives. And the way that the commentators explain this is that a nefesh rechava, this insatiable nefesh, this insatiable spirit, means that Bilam was always out there searching for physical pleasure. He couldn't get enough of it. Abraham was somebody who was content with what he had. He could keep his drives, you know, in control, and didn't need so much to make himself feel physically content. That's what Abraham was about. And we find that with Abraham. Abraham was somebody who separated from physical desire. He didn't even notice how beautiful his wife was until later on in his life, the Torah says. Only when he was, you know, in his 80s or 90s did he say, oh wow, you're so beautiful, we have to keep you away from the Egyptians. You know, but the rabbis say that physical desire wasn't what drove him. So of course he loved his wife, the great relationship, etc. But he wasn't looking at her with this like physical eye of beauty. They had a different type of relationship. Only when he was entering into Egypt, he knew they were immoral in Egypt, and he needed to protect her, he noticed, oh wow, you're a very beautiful woman, I better protect you and keep you, and you know, they went through the whole plot about calling him his sister, etc. But Abraham was somebody who had this spirit that he didn't need so much physical pleasure to keep him going. The Bilam was somebody always wanted more. I mean, his name again is, we swallow everything up, Balaam, Bilea, to swallow it all up. And he's somebody who, he plotted against the Jews. After the story, He arranged an entire plot against the Jews. He said, what we're going to do, because I couldn't curse the Jews, what I'm going to do, I'm going to round up all these Midianite girls and send them into the Jewish camp to seduce the Jews. And when God sees the Jews are getting involved with these non-Jewish women, so that's, they're going to be, they're, this is a big sin, and therefore Hashem will be upset with the Jews at that point, and then Hashem will remove his protection from them. So his whole plot was to seduce them physically using non-Jewish women. And the Kabbalists point out, because that was on his mind was always physical desires, physical desires. So because he had that on his mind, that's why he was the one who was able to orchestrate this plot of seducing the Jews through it as well. He was somebody, the rabbis describe more of how he was somebody always out there looking for more physical pleasure. So that was his attitude. Whereas Avraham was somebody who was very content and satiated and didn't need so much more than what he had. He was able to control his physical drives. So those are the three different traits that are contrasted. And going back to the other Mishnah we quoted, so we said that honor, desire, and jealousy remove you from this world. So we talked about jealousy. The honor is his, Bilam had arrogance, right? That was the honor. And he also had taiva, the physical drive. He also had the nefesh rechava, this insatiable spirit. That was the taiva, the physical desire. And between those three, that removes a person from this world. And I'll discuss that more in a minute, what it means to be removed from the world. But those are the three different traits of Avraham. By the way, Avraham was able to keep all those in control. He didn't look for honor. He didn't chase all of his physical desires. And he wasn't jealous of others. He hoped others would succeed. He looked at others with a very favorable eye. And therefore, Avraham was the one who was able to found the Jewish people. And Bilam was the one who was destined for destruction. Those are two of these contrasted individuals. Those are the traits listed in the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. What's interesting is that, so as Bilam, as spiritual as he could have been, he is somebody who had potential to really, really be a leader, be a very powerful religious figure. He was prophetic. He was very much in tap with his own spirit. But his corrupted character traits really prevented him from really succeeding in that. The rabbis even say that he had potential to be in the level of Moshe. That's how powerful his spirit could have been. But yet, Bilam, because he couldn't keep his negative character traits under control, so that really drove him off a cliff, is what it did. That was his problem. But the rabbis say that Bilam was offered to the non-Jews as sort of, you know, their version of Moshe. Meaning that if they were to come to God and say, it's not fair, the Jews had somebody the caliber of Moshe to lead them. So where's our leader? So the rabbis say that God said, your leader is Bilam. Bilam is somebody who has the potential of Moshe. Let's see what he can do. And Bilam wasn't able to keep himself in control, and he failed in that sense.
He couldn't keep his negative character traits under control.
Right. That was his major problem. So he wasn't able to tap into the goodness of Moshe. Rather, he became this very corrupt leader who rented himself out to others to curse and destroy, and became a very terrible person. So the Mishnah continues. And the Mishnah says, now that we've contrasted the two people, the Mishnah says, what are these two people destined for? What's their reward and punishment? So this is a student of Avraham. He gets reward in this world. And he also will inherit the next world. As it says, I will give to those who love me yesh. Yesh means existence, you know, reality, substance. In Hebrew, modern Hebrew, if you say, I have something, I say yeshli, I have. So if I'm giving you yesh, I'm giving you reality, I'm giving you substance. And I'll fill up their storehouses. And it says, what about Bilam? A student of Bilam, where is he destined for? He says, Yorshin Gehenim. They inherit Gehenim, they inherit hell, and they descend into the pit of destruction. As it says, Vatad Elokim Tardim Vershachas, you Hashem, you will lower them down into the pit of destruction. Anshe Damim Mira, people of blood and deceit. They won't even meet half their days. Baniyev Tahba, but I'll have trusted you. So the contrast in terms of the ultimate destiny of a student of Bilam, a student of Avraham, is very interesting. Because a student of Bilam ends up in a pit of destruction because they're people of deceit, of deception. And a student of Avraham ends up with full storehouses, and he ends up with yesh, with existence, with reality, with substance. And it's a fascinating contrast, and I'll explain why. Because the Mishnah we quoted before, Mishnah says, kina, jealousy, taiva, physical desire, kavod, honor, remove you from the world. So which world are you removed from? So certainly somebody who lives a life of jealousy, honor, and desire is removed from the next world. That's for sure. I mean, that person is not living a life of Torah and mitzvot. They're not performing their duties to God. So certainly the next world is not going to be on their schedule. But also it means this world. A person who lives a life of desire, seeking honor, and jealous of everybody else, they have a pretty terrible life in this world as well. There's something always eating at them. I need something else. I'm not happy. I'm not content. I need more honor. People don't respect me enough. I need more pleasure. I'm not having the pleasure in life. Why does he have what I don't have? I need his house, I need his car, I need everything else. And they don't enjoy this life either. So jealousy, honor, and desire remove you from the next world, from the spiritual world, remove you from this world, because you're not going to enjoy life in this world. But even further than that, it takes you out of reality. I mean, life becomes a fantasy. I'm always striving for my next fantasy. My imagination is always, what else can I get? What else can I have? You don't focus in on your own personal achievement. Rather, you're always trying to find something else. Somebody who's content with what they have. You know, they're content. They're not searching for others' approval. They're not searching for desire. They're happy with their own possessions. So then they can focus in on accomplishing, on achieving, on producing something real, a life of substance. If you're always looking outwards, that I need somebody to give me honor. I need to have what you have. I need to have my next physical pleasure achieved and fulfilled. So your life is a life it's imaginary, it's fantasy. There's no substance there because you're always looking for something else. You're never focusing down and achieving. So, and that's what these traits do to a person. So, gaiva, if somebody is arrogant, you need honor. You think you're the center of the world. Well, that's a joke because we're not the center of the world. Each one of us is a big world. And each one of us is part of the world, but none of us are the center of the world. And really, God's the center of the world. And all credit should be attributed to God, not to ourselves. And if we start thinking we're the center of the world, everyone should be praising us, giving us credit, etc. So then it's a joke. It's a fantasy. It's not reality. It's not real. And when a person, after 120 years, you die and go up to God, so you understand it's a joke. Because you weren't the center of the world, God was the center of the world.
Our credit needs to be focused, you said, on God.
Right, yeah, right. I mean, arrogance means that I think I should get credit for everything. You know, I'm the best. It's all from me. In truth, the way humility comes from the sense that really God is always there helping me. All my talents, my possessions, what I've achieved is because Hashem has allowed me to achieve it. So I can't become arrogant because it's not me. It's because there have been others there who helped me along the way. Hashem gave it to me. Yeah, right. So it's a gift. So I can't become arrogant because I got a gift. So, but arrogance means I think it's all from myself, which really is not true. It's a joke. It's not reality. And sometimes we even meet people who their ego has gone so much to their heads. We look at them and we can tell they're a joke. I'm saying they take themselves very seriously, but we don't take them seriously because you know your ego can really get to you and make you really feel that you are the center of it all, and all everyone around you can tell it's totally ridiculous. You know. But there are people like that whose arrogance goes to their heads to that extent. Jealousy. Jealousy means I'm focusing on what others have and not what Hashem gave to me. So really I have to focus on, my goal in life is to produce. I have to succeed and produce, be a good person, do mitzvos, help others, serve God. That's how I produce. I produce based on the tools Hashem gave to me. If I think, well, I need what you have, 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 so then I'm focused not on what I have to do. I'm not producing. Rather, I'm complaining. I'm thinking, I don't have enough that I need to produce. I don't have my tools. We spoke about this a few weeks back, how really everything we have is our own personal tools to serve God with. And those are the proper tools. And if I try to eat soup with a fork, it doesn't work. And if I try to use your tools for my job, it doesn't work. I mean, because what Hashem gives me in life are the tools that I'm supposed to use for my job in this world. We all have our own jobs in this world. But when I'm jealous and I think, well, I need what you have and what you have and what you have, then I'm not doing my job. I'm trying to do something else and I'm not producing. So I have to understand that what others' achievements, what others have, has nothing to do with me. Hashem runs the world. And what I have is what I need to succeed. And what you have is not what I need to succeed. That's what you need to succeed. But I need to succeed what I have. That's my proper tools. So if you live a life of jealousy, you're never focusing on yourself. You're always focusing in on what others have. You're not able to appreciate what you have and produce in your own life based on what Hashem gave you. So you don't end up with yesh. You don't have substance in life. You end up with fantasy. It's imaginary. You're not producing what you're supposed to be producing. And the third thing mentioned is type of a physical desire. Physical desire is a part of life, but yet it's a temporary pleasure. It's a fleeting pleasure. It's not an accomplishment that has any eternal meaning. You have a good steak, so you enjoy it for the moment. But beyond that, there's no eternal benefits of a good steak. So we build our lives. Okay, I need to make more money so that I can afford to have a good meal and go on a good vacation and have a nice house. But these things, in the big picture, are not eternal accomplishments. They're temporary accomplishments. They may be pleasurable in a temporary way. But in terms of the big picture reality, it's not a reality. Because after 120 years, we go up to God, and we don't take along with us our house and our stake and anything else. So that's something which people build lives of emptiness focused totally around physical pleasure. I mean, there are people whose whole lives are so built around it, they destroy themselves and their relationships and their marriage because they're so focused on getting more pleasure out of life. And really, it's all imaginary, and at the end of the day, they've got nothing out of it. They end up destroying what they do have and losing out on anything of meaning in life. So somebody's a student of Bilam who actually follows in these terrible ways. They end up not with Yesh, but they're people of deceit. They're imaginary people. They have nothing to show for themselves. They lived life thinking that they were accomplishing, but yet when their whole life is focused on honor and desire and jealousy, they walk away with absolutely nothing out of life. Somebody's a student of Abraham, so his storehouses are filled up, the rabbis say. He has Yesh, he has substance, because if you live a life where you don't need honor from others, you're happy with what you have, you understand that your possessions are what Hashem allotted to you to serve Him, you realize that physical desire is not in and of itself an accomplishment in the big picture, so you focus in on more important things, and you walk away from life being a good person, helping others, achieving, accomplishing in a real eternal way, in a spirit based on the Torah, spirituality, on mitzvos, and you walk away with reality, with true existence, eternal existence. A life like Bilam's life, so they end up, you know, going down to the pit of destruction, never to be heard from again, because their lives are imaginary lives of fantasy. It doesn't get you anywhere. So where do we want to place ourselves in this picture? We all want to live lives of reality, we want to live lives of substance, and lives of real meaningful achievement. So we have to make sure we align ourselves as students of Abraham and not students of Bilam. And all of us definitely have, you know, Bilam traits within us, and we have to weed them out and work with them and control them. But overall, if we align ourselves with our ancestor Abraham, who's the Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many, many nations, he is the ultimate person to produce in this world. He's the one, this one individual was such a powerful person that the whole world looks at him as their father, as their leader, and he produced an entire world of monotheists. Which is truly an eternal achievement. Abraham is sort of the paradigm of that. But in our own lives, so number one, in terms of this haughty spirit of Bilam, we have to realize that really I'm not the center, but Hashem is the center. What I have is a gift from Hashem. What I achieve is because Hashem allowed me to achieve it. The Ayin Hara, this evil eye, we have to understand that my possessions, my talents, my wealth are because Hashem allowed me to have them. They're my tools to use for success in this world, but I shouldn't look at you askance. What you do does not affect me, and if you succeed, that's great. I want you to succeed. I want everyone to succeed. I want everyone to live a good life and be good people. And Nefesh Rechava, this insatiable spirit, so it teaches us that Bilam had this insatiable spirit, always searching for more and more physical desire, and we have to understand that true accomplishment lies not in the world of physical pleasure, but when we want real, eternal gains in the world, in the realm of Torah and spirituality and service of Hashem. Which means Torah, which means mitzvos, studying Torah, doing acts of chesed, helping others, doing what's right, being moral, ethical, honest. Those are truly eternal achievements. Chasing physical desire is something which is exciting, but is fleeting and is temporary. And that's not a true accomplishment. So Bilam had this insatiable spirit, always looking for more and more physical desire. We say, no, that's not the way to live life. That's fantasy. That's imaginary. And any pleasure you have is only temporary. But we live lives where we're looking for real eternal achievement, really eternal success, really eternal pleasure. So that's the contrast we'll end up here. That's the contrast between Bilam and Abraham. So just to recap, you know, Bilam was this person with so much potential. He was given as a leader, given as someone who can really tap into the realm of spirituality and really communicate with God. But because he couldn't keep his midos in control, he corrupted himself. And we look at him as a paradigm of terrible midos, of being a terrible person. And we look at Abraham, who is his really an opposite of Bilam, as sort of a paradigm of somebody who we can really emulate. As our patriarch, Abraham is within all of us, and we can emulate Abraham. And if you live a life like Abraham, you end up with a life of substance and reality and eternal pleasure. If you have a life like Bilam, you end up in the pit of destruction with nothing to show for yourself. So we all know which direction we want to go in. Yeah. Yes?
Your possessions are what God gave you to serve God.
Right. Right, the possessions, I mean, Hashem gave us all the tools we need in life. And what someone else has is not the tool I need. What I have is the tool I need. If I live an honest life and I work and I get what I need, those are the tools Hashem allowed to me. If I think, well, I wish I had what you have, but that's not what Hashem gave to me in life. That's not my proper tool. That's like eating soup with a fork. That's what it is.
Right.
Not the tool I need. It's the wrong tool. you know, brushing my teeth with a hammer. Like, it doesn't work.
Right.
You know, I have to have the right tools. So my right tools are the ones Hashem allotted me in life. Those are my right tools.
Yeah, thank you.
Shema in this situation. I love God with our hearts.
Right.
And I like that expression. We've got a good legal inclination. And so we want to love God with our evil inclination too.
So great.
We want to love God with our good inclination.
Right.
We want to love Him with our evil inclination.
Right.
So to love Him with the evil inclination means you have to bend and twist and reform that
right.
to serve God.
We all have egos, we all have physical desires, we all, you know, want honor, etc. But what is?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's two, there's two bases, yeah. Right.
What happened to Bilam?
So at the end, he was actually killed in battle against the Jewish people. No, that was someone. Pinchas, it wasn't that instance, but I don't remember if it was Pinchas who killed him. I think Pinchas did kill him, right. He was killed. He was. Yeah, right, and we killed him in that battle. He was killed in that battle.
But didn't he send Pinchas to run that battle?
Hashem sent, yeah, I think Pinchas ran that battle, right? I think if I remember correctly, it's coming up. I think this was Parsha. Right. Yeah, so he was killed in battle against the Jews, and then it says here the end of the story is straight to the pit of destruction. The end of the story.
What?
In Pirkei Avos, it says at the end of the story of Bilam is he goes straight into the pit of destruction.
Really?
He inherits Gehenna, straight to destruction. Yeah, that's how the Mishnah describes Bilam's fate at the end.
The Mishnah